Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
You're listening to the White Sox Talk Podcast, brought to you by Wintrust. Chuck Arfine with you, and it is another edition of Distant Replay, where we look back at a classic White Sox game and dissect everything that happened, reliving the big moments, unearthing stats and behind-the-scenes stories that have never been told or have completely been forgotten. Today, it's one of the craziest games in the history of baseball. I'm not kidding. Featuring one of the most unluckiest stretches for a pitcher, also in the history of baseball, we are not overstating this. July 1st, 1990, the Yankees' Andy Hawkins pitched a no-hitter against the White Sox. But the White Sox won the game 4-0. For this to happen, complete insanity has to occur, and it did. So we're going to break it all down. We're going to talk to Andy Hawkins himself. It's the White Sox Talk Podcast. One of the craziest games in the history of baseball. Let's do it.
White Sox! White Sox! Go! Go! White Sox!
That ball hit deep, way back! Deep to left field!
Holy cow! Carlton Fisk has put the White Sox ahead!
Jimenez leaves the ballpark!
You can't put it on the board! Yes!
We got a chance to do something real special.
All right, sit back, relax, and strap it down. It's time for the White Sox Talk Podcast.
The baseball guide and the one most people pray to are two entirely different entities. Baseball guide has got a sick sense of humor.
Sammy at third, Ozzie at second, Lance at first. Outfield bunch swung around to the left. That's hitting the left field playable. Leyritz fighting the wind, drops the ball! Drops the ball! Everybody's going to score, and the Sox lead it 3-0! Yes!
Bedlam at Old Comiskey Park, a three-run error in the eighth. The White Sox win a game 4-0 without getting a single hit. And this only begins to tell the story about the game, the hard luck pitcher Andy Hawkins, and the 1990 White Sox, who had the baseball gods with them in the final season ever at Old Comiskey Park. All right, here with Ryan McGuffey, Chris Kempka, and Vinny Duber, we all rewatched the game from July 1st, 1990. Now, Guff, you and I have had this game circled on our calendars for how long?
A good 3 years.
Not just for this podcast. We want to do something with this.
I think we were talking about this specific game, and then while we were looking, I just happened to go through his game logs, and I remember you looking at me like, what? Because my jaw dropped. And the sequence of those, his first three starts in July, I think, and we have the guy that could confirm this in the room, are the worst stretch of luck in the history of baseball for a pitcher.
What do you think, Chris?
It's hard to find anybody who's worse.
Obviously he pitches the no-hitter on July 1st and loses the game 4-0, which we're going to get into here in a second. 5 days later, he starts game one of a doubleheader against the Twins. Goes 11 2/3. 11 2/3. Gives up a two-run walk-off.
In the 11th, right.
In the 12th.
In the 12th, yes, right.
12th. Loses 2-0. And then 6 days later, he plays the White Sox. The best part about the story is this whole thing is bookended by the White Sox. Starts with the White Sox, ends with the White Sox. He goes out and loses. He's on the other side of a no-hitter. Melito Perez throws a rain-shortened no-hitter for the White Sox, and the Yankees lose 8-0.
He wasn't unlucky in that
game.
Well,
he got beat up. But the fact that he is on the other side of a no-hitter, you know, I mean, he throws a no-hitter.
He went from having the worst luck having a no-hitter to someone getting the best luck on a no-hitter because the rain came.
That's nicely put. And then, eventually, there were no-hitters at all, and we'll get into that as well.
Andy Hawkins had a whopping run support total of 0 in those three starts. 0.
That's the unlucky part, isn't it?
Yes. And you're going to hear from Andy talking about this. So Let's start with Comiskey Park, because that was the backstory to this game. It was the last season ever at Comiskey Park. July 1st, this game we're talking about, was the park's 80th birthday and was the Yankees' last game ever in this ballpark. And for those of us who grew up going to this ballpark, we all have amazing memories of this place.
Love the green seats and gold railings.
Box seats.
Anytime I see that, it just brings a smile to my face. But if there were baseball gods, forget about winning this game. Why didn't the baseball gods save old Comiskey? That's what they could have done.
Hey, man. The golden box, that's exactly what came to mind. When we got tickets as a kid, it would just, in typewriter font on the ticket, it would tell you where you're sitting, upper deck, whatever, bleachers, or golden box seats. And I remember the two or three times a year, it's like, oh, my God, we're sitting with the railings.
Yeah,
like,
that was awesome. Always
you know
special.
How many balls would come off the roof and hit those golden box and, like, just pinball off of people? It was insane.
I have a few of those seats that we bought from the fire sale after they tore it down. And I want to install them in my house, but that's not enough. I want to put a gold railing in front of them.
Oh, yes. Make that happen.
Yeah.
My dad, 1 year or maybe two, I think it was 1986 and 87, got season tickets for us. And the season tickets were in a location where I think they're my favorite seats in the whole park, or were in the whole park. It was first base side, upper deck.
Oh, I know exactly.
Fourth row. You felt like you were over the field.
You were. You kind of were.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a great story about those seats.
What do you got?
I have great stories about Old Comiskey Park, but I caught a foul ball off the bat of Mike Greenwell. Of the Red Sox. My mom had just came back from buying us these huge slushes. They were probably like 32-ounce slushes. I was with my best friend, my brother, and his brother. And it was with my parents. I catch this foul ball. In my glove, I mean, I see it off the bat. I drop the slush immediately. It shatters all over the place. I had just gotten it. Catch it. There's a whole bunch of people that pile up on top of you. People are clapping, and a woman yanks it out of my glove. Oh, trust me. It's the...
Damaging.
Obviously, I've gone to therapy for this. but it was she got booed. She didn't get kicked out. She kept the ball.
Wow.
She kept the ball.
We gotta find this woman.
That was
dare she.
That was. It still haunts me, Vinny. If you want to talk about it after this.
All right, Dr. Vinny, get to that. All right, let's get to the 1990 White Sox, because this was the youngest team in the majors. Frank Thomas and Alex Fernandez had yet to be even called up, and yet when they took the field on this day, they were 45-26, tied with the A's for the best record in the majors. And Wimpy that whole season kept saying this. Who are these guys? Because, really, who were these guys, Chris Kamka?
The team made no sense, okay? So, like you said, the youngest team in the majors, and who led that team in home runs? Well, the oldest position player in the majors, Carlton Fisk, at age 42, had led the team with 18 home runs. He had a 5-win season. It's one of the best old player seasons in Major League history. And here's the fun part. After Fisk, the next most home runs was by Ron Kittle, who had 16, who was traded on July 30th and still was second on the team in home runs. And they ran a lot, and as Hawk would say in the broadcast, he had this weird quote, "They're a running bunch of Jessies once they get on first base," which I've never heard that before. They had 90 times caught stealing. The next most in the American League was 72, so they're a little reckless.
Well, Wimpy refers to general manager Larry Himes during the broadcast as Dr. Frankenstein because he, quote, built this monster. So you could tell how confused Wimpy even was. And I think the funny comparison that Hawk made during the broadcast, too, comparing the not only young but low-priced Chicago White Sox to the exorbitant spending of who else but the Kansas City Royals with their whopping $23 million payroll, also referred to the A's as the high-priced Oakland A's. Very strange considering we consider the A's and the Royals to be two of the lowest spending teams on an annual basis.
That A's team that was tied with the White Sox, the Sox team had Sosa, who was 21, Ventura, 22, Jack McDowell, 24. They were so young. The A's had McGuire, Canseco, Ricky Henderson, Dave Henderson, Harold Baines, Dave Stewart, and Dennis Eckersley in his prime.
Well, keep in mind, they won the World Series in 89, and they lost the World Series to the Reds in 90.
But the fact that the White Sox were tied, this young White Sox team was tied with them on July 1st for the best record in baseball.
I know. It is crazy, but their pitching was fantastic. And the one point I brought up to you guys in the newsroom, I believe yesterday or 2 days ago, was that the team – some of the players on the team remind me of the current-day White Sox. I know the record necessarily doesn't, But because of where these guys are coming, the Ventura, you had four straight years of number one picks. I don't know exact order here, but it was McDowell, Ventura, Fernandez, Thomas, and they're all on this team, and they're all young, and they're up and coming. And that pitching staff was lights out. The bullpen was lights out. Jeff Torberg was one of the best managers in the game. Obviously, they had the wrong. They're on the wrong side of the veterans, but it was like kind of a perfect mix of youth and veteran.
Well, that's the amazing thing. Okay, so you mentioned that amazing run of four straight number one picks. Thomas and Fernandez hadn't even made their debuts yet, and those are two real impact guys. They both made their debut in the same game. Yeah. Now think about that. Consecutive number one picks. I mean, Thomas was taken seventh overall and Fernandez fourth. They both debuted in the same game. That's prospect firepower right there.
You talk about the comparison to the modern-day White Sox. That brings your attention to 2020. How about the intro that Hawk reads?
Thank you.
And the 1990 team that promises excitement, competitiveness, and youth.
I wrote that. I was hoping that somebody was going to say it because I wrote that down. It was clearly like their game open. That was their every. It was like a taped game open preseason. It was clear like, hey, we don't know the message of this team, but it's going to be exciting and competitive and young.
Well, let's get to the game. Hawk and Wimpy on Sports Channel. A sunny and windy day. I say sunny and windy because this would play a big part in this game. You would see gusts of wind where the dirt would come off the ground at times because of the wind. You could see New Comiskey Park being built across the street. It looked like a spaceship, right? And Bill Jouse in the Chicago Tribune wrote a game story for this game, and this will give you an idea of what's ahead. He started the article by saying this: if the New Comiskey Park, currently under construction across 35th Street, lasts another 80 years, it will not house a stranger game than the one the White Sox won 4-0 over the Yankees on their final game in Comiskey Park.
AJ's dropped third strike is pretty close.
And it was weird before the first pitch was thrown. It was bat day, and there was a delay getting fans into the park.
Yep.
Because it opened barely an hour before the game time because the bats were late in arriving.
Did you see what time first pitch was?
No.
2:38 p.m.
2:38.
Right. Isn't that a weird, like, it's, I mean, weird. Clearly this first pitch was probably 2:30. It's just a weird, must have been like the Sunday home game start time, like the, just weird.
But what's funny about bat day, they don't do bat days anymore.
No.
We have too violent of a society, apparently. They used to hand out real bats to everybody. Now if they did that, something would happen, right?
We need help.
Yeah, we need help. There'd be some lawsuits. Okay.
Fun thing about this game, though, Chuck.
Yeah, what do you got?
I mean, Hawk Harrelson at this time is as old as you are now. Think about that.
Oh, my
man.
Goodness.
I don't know who's supposed to feel good about
that. The podcast has... I'm going to go leave and talk to my therapist.
Yeah, yeah. And, did you also notice...
I don't have a therapist. I'm going to go find one now.
I have a guy, so...
Mike, Camco, thank you very much
for that.
Did
you also notice in the game open that there is no Hawk because he introduces himself only as Ken Harrelson?
Really?
And he does not ask you to sit back, relax, and strap it down.
Boom. All right. So with that, let's get to... You gotta be bleeping me, which is what we do for every distant replay. Things that surprised us rewatching the game or just Hawk being Hawk. Number one I had, I mean, this is so Hawk. Hawk is wearing a Chicago White Sox hat calling this game. Can you think of anybody in the history of any sport wearing the hat of the team calling the game?
But also, when you say that, we all go, yeah, of course he was. Like, that's not,
he's
if you know
White
Hawk,
Sox
that's
hat.
Not surprising
it's
in the
so,
least.
It's so funny.
Well, the thing is, like, Hawk's like the only guy who actually wore a hat during the broadcast. If you think about it, everyone's like got a nice, you know, dress shirt on or, you know, suit or something. But then here's Hawk with a hat.
All right. Steve Balboni was on the Yankees. The Yankees, by the way, were the worst team in baseball when this game began. They were in a rebuild. Steve Balboni, the guy looks like a Neanderthal. He's got like the bat looks like a toothpick in his hand.
He looks like the guy who's like serving your Christmas dinner or something. Like, he's just like, well, the ham's out of the oven, guys. Come up with a bad sweater. And he put, like, Uncle Steve comes in, puts the, let's eat. And Kampka texted us a picture. I'm standing up now. Texted us a picture of Steve Balboni on our text thread. I don't know if you noticed that.
I saw that, I had
to ask Chris. I'm like,
who is that?
Steve Balboni.
Yeah, because he was, like, completely bald by then.
Yeah, he looked like he should be in Mr. Belvedere.
Right, and that was during his game career, too. I mean, he had the bald completely on top and the little ring around the side. and his swing was really weird. It looked like he didn't even extend his arms from his torso. He just kind of like moved his whole torso along with the swing. But the swing was good enough to set a Royals record with 36 homers in 85, which stood until 2017.
One more note on Steve Balboni. Every 80s baseball movie that was always the opponent's best player was supposed to be Steve Balboni.
Yes,
to me.
And about that, okay, so he reminded me of Clu Haywood from Major League. Yes. But the thing is, Clu Haywood in Major League was played by Pete Vukovic, who actually pitched for the White Sox.
Wait, wow. Pete Vukovic pitched for the White Sox? When?
In the beginning of his career.
I didn't
then
know
he
that.
Went on to Milwaukee, won the Cy Young.
And
he was Clu Haywood.
He had, 23 size feet? He had big feet.
That sounds about right.
All right, center field bleachers packed with, if you were a man in the center field bleachers, what were you not wearing?
Shirt.
80% of the attendees at this game were shirtless.
Agreed.
I was like, was it don't wear a shirt day at Comiskey Park? Because and listen, I've seen old clips of not only Comiskey Park but Wrigley Field and all the parks from that, and that seemed to be par for the course. But I mean, guys, some of those guys would have been better served wearing a shirt.
And mullets everywhere.
In 2020, though, it's more shocking to see, like, if you see a guy, like, running down Lakeshore Drive and not wearing a shirt, it's like, hey, bud, they may dry fit now. You know, like, whereas in 1990, no one wore shirts to the mall.
That's true. All right. You guys are going to, everyone listening, you're going to love this. Biggest surprise of the game, not involving the game. They cut to a guy in a suite. It's Phil Jackson. Mm. All right. And Hawk says, congratulations on a terrific season. Now, they had just lost to the Pistons, the Bulls did, in the Eastern Conference Finals in 7 games. Hawk goes, they gave us a lot of thrills. They'll get them next year. And Hawk was right. They swept the Pistons in the Eastern Conference Finals. They beat the Lakers in 5 in the Finals. Now, who wants to take what's next?
I'll see.
We'll tag team it, Chris.
Go ahead, Vinny.
So, Hawk. Was talking to, and I'm sorry, I did not write down the employee. You probably, do you have it there? The Bulls employee that the Hawkaroo was talking
to?
Steve Shanwald.
So there you go. I was talking to Steve Shanwald, you know, before the game, and he was telling me all about this guy they just drafted out of Europe. 6'10 shooting guard. Name is Tulik. Tulik? Who's Tulik? I think we put it together, and I did confirm on Pro Basketball Reference, the Hawkaroo is referring to Tony Kukoc.
Right. Now, to his defense, in 1990, there were very, 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 very few European basketball players in the NBA. Like, Kukoc was, like, one of the first. So to have a name like that, like a guy like Hawk Harrelson, or anybody for that matter, would see that name and go, I don't even know what this person's name.
I believe K is a cut and not a tongue.
I don't know why I'm trying to defend Hawk.
Just because it's European doesn't mean it.
Yeah,
the whole
you're right.
The pronunciation changes.
He combined the first and second name into one incorrect name. Apparently, he thinks this is like Cher or something that he goes by one name.
Tony Tulik, or just Tulik?
Just Tulik.
Well,
all right. Come on, Hawk.
My favorite is Wimpy. Kind of just is like, yeah.
Like, he didn't know either.
Wimpy wasn't talking to anybody before the game.
Now, do we tell the Hawk joke in this podcast?
I think you already.
You kind of have to now. It's not a good joke.
I can tell the joke, and then we can decide if I'm going to do the punchline or not.
Ugh. It's not a good joke. It's a cringeworthy Hawk joke.
Tony Gill, should we do it or not?
I want to see it. I want to hear it.
Okay. All right, here we go. What's the difference between a wife and a terrorist?
I mean, it's already.
I told you.
Okay, Google that. Maybe someone has a punchline on the internet. Hawk said this on the air. Okay. This is why we love Hawk and why we love Distant Replay. All right.
And it was a 6'10 shooting guard, Tulik. Back in my day, if you were 6'10, you couldn't even stand up straight. So there's that.
All right. Now let's get to the game. Greg Hibbard versus Andy Hawkins. Greg Hibbard was known as the Little Bulldog. He looked like the Little Hurt. Didn't he look like Craig Raybrick?
He's probably the tallest guy at 6 feet tall that was called Little.
Yeah.
I've noticed that. He's probably shorter than that.
Hibbard always reminded me, because I grew up on those teams, but Hibbard always reminded me of like the first installment of Mark Burley.
Okay.
Didn't strike out a lot of guys, pitched deep into games. Figured out how to pitch around guys, and then you'd always see a stat line go, wow.
Pretty accurate.
They were promoting White Sox Weekly on television during the game. Hawk says, Jeff Torborg is going to model the new uniforms for 1991. They had not been seen yet. Hawk said, I heard they're gorgeous. And these are the same uniforms to this day that the White Sox are wearing.
Speaking of uniforms, did you also catch the promotion for a retro day coming up at Comiskey Park where they were going to wear 1917 uniforms? Tickets were going to be 50 cents. The question I have is, did those 1917 uniforms survive, or was a certain pitcher involved in destroying them?
I was at that game.
Wow.
And not only that, they took them, there was a baseball card that I guarantee you have.
There was a lot of them that they did.
That they actually took the photos at the new Comiskey Park wearing those same
1991
uniforms.
Upper Deck, it was a team shot.
Boom.
But that year, a lot of manufacturers did pictures of White Sox in those uniforms because they were so cool.
Keep in mind, Field of Dreams had just come out in 1989.
Right, and I think this was the first throwback game ever in baseball.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was.
That part
sure it was.
And
yeah.
I mean, the theme was, you know, throwback. This is the 80th anniversary of the ballpark. And I found it amazing that not only did they have two people that were born on that day, July 1st, 1910, they had two people in attendance that were at that game of July 1st, 1910. That was amazing. So to put that in perspective, as far as new Comiskey Park, Guaranteed Rate Field, Nolan Arenado was born 2 days before new Comiskey Park / Guaranteed Rate Field was open, just to kind of get a little perspective on that.
And make us feel old.
Right.
There is so much to this game. We're like almost a half hour into the podcast. We haven't even talked about Andy Hawkins. So let's jump ahead here. I have Steve Sachs in here, but I think we're just going to have to skip past him. What did Hawk
call? The original Crimson Fanny?
Okay. Steve Sachs loses his mind in this game because he makes an out. He whips his bat in the stairway leading to the clubhouse, and Hawk goes, Jimmy, talking to Jim Angio. That's my act when I was playing. When I hit one off the end of the bat and broke it, guys in the dugout started scattering. And then, in the sixth inning, Hibbert gets out of the inning. Sachs is called out on strikes. He goes nuts on Dale Scott and is not thrown out of the game. When you see a player today go at it with an umpire, they are thrown out immediately. Steve Sachs stays in this game.
It's just a different era.
Yeah.
I mean, today, if you even turn around to try to argue, you're gone.
I think it was the language. You know, he's probably, gosh darn it, that was a
Golly
horse
G.
feathers call right there, and that's probably why he wasn't thrown out.
I'd be remiss, too, if I didn't bring up that is Steve Sachs' running with the law, and Simpsons fans know from the softball episode. That's the misfortune that befalls Steve Sachs. Two of Mr. Burns' all-stars on this Yankee team, Steve Sachs and Don Mattingly.
As I watched that game, I asked myself, was Sachs packed with socks? I had no answer for that.
Well, there would be a time that they will be. There will be a time on this podcast the Sachs will be socked. No,
the Sachs are packed with socks.
The
Sachs
will be
there. Sachs.
All right, Chris Kampka, give me some stuff on Andy Hawkins.
So,
who is this person? Who was this pitcher?
Here's a fun thing about him. His full name was Melton Andrew Hawkins, as in Bill Melton. So that's fun. So he had a great performance in the 1984 World Series for the Padres.
Yes, against the Cubs.
Yeah, I mean, and the NLCS and the World Series combined, and he had like 15 innings and one run allowed. So then he had a career year the next year. But another fun part of history with Hawkins is this. In 1988, the final game of the season, it was a 16-inning, 2-1 San Diego win. It was a scoreless duel between Andy Hawkins and Oral Hershiser. They both went 10 innings. And it is the fact that Hawkins kept the game scoreless that Hershiser was able to get that 10th inning of work and therefore beat Don Drysdale's record for consecutive scoreless innings.
Interesting.
So there's a little spot in history with Andy Hawkins. And then here he is today. He was only on the Yankees for this reason. The Yankees said, we're going to demote you or we're going to release you. And Hawkins said, you know, release. But at that point, the next day, Mike Witt, who also was the author of A Perfect Game, got injured. And so then the Yankees needed Hawkins, and that's the only reason he was on the team.
So this game did not have a hit for a very long time. It was Hawkins against Hibbert. The first 29 hitters all made outs. At one point, you have Ivan Calderon coming up to the plate. In the bottom of the fourth, Hawk goes, Ivan Calderon's going to break it up right here. First pitch, weak grounder to shortstop. He's out. So that didn't work out. Bottom of the fifth, both pitchers throwing a perfect game. Hawk and Wimpy could not believe it. Listen in.
It's the bottom of the fifth inning. Pasqua, Kittle, and Karkovice. And how long has it been? A little trivia question for you. How long has it been since you've seen a game halfway finished and nary a base runner?
Never. I don't think I have.
I'll tell you, there has yet to be a base runner in this ball game. Both pitchers, Hibbert and Hawkins, have been perfect. Greg threw five, and here, and Hawkins threw four. I don't ever recall.
All right, so there was something special going on with this game. Meanwhile, there was this young kid that was just called up to the majors the year before, got traded from the Rangers to the White Sox in the Harold Baines trade. His name was Sammy Sosa. What was it like to see Sammy Sosa again, but this time in a White Sox uniform?
It was weird. And you remember the potential he had, but he was frustrating. He struck out a ton. But just to give you an idea, let me quote Hawk here. When the day comes, that young man right there, 21-year-old Sammy Sosa, as Tom is his spouse so often, learns how to lay off the high fastball up out of the zone, you're going to see one heck of an offensive ball player.
Yep. Turned out to be okay.
He was looking svelte back in 1990.
Yes, he was.
He was much smaller than we, you know, came to know him. Also, ample hair on Sammy back then.
Plenty of good hair. So he was the only one, Sammy Sosa, to really hit the ball hard off of Hawkins. He just missed a home run. And when I interviewed Hawkins, we're going to play that a good part of that interview later in this podcast, but one thing that's not in there, Hawkins said, look, it was a really windy day. When Sosa hit that ball, I thought it was going to go on the roof. He smoked it, but the wind brought it back. It did not get over the fence, but it was a classic Sammy swing, no doubt about it. So Hibbert, Greg Hibbert, goes seven innings, four hits, no runs, no walks, four strikeouts. Hawk said about him, he's a bulldog. Once he gets his teeth into you, he's not going to let go. I love quoting Hawk. So Hibbert retired the first 16 Yankees hitters. Bottom of the eighth inning. Now we get to the nitty-gritty of this game. Hawkins has a no-hitter going. He gets two quick routine outs, but then we've got controversy. Sammy Sosa's at the plate. Someone want to take this, or you want me to just kind of just explain what transpired here? The ground ball to third.
Yeah, he reached on the air. And
by Mike Blowers.
Yeah, but it looked like at first it was going to be ruled a hit.
It was ruled a hit
right.
First.
Well, Bob Rosenberg.
It was ruled a hit.
I think that was a mistake because Rosenberg later said many thought that this is on account of the game. Many thought he had first called a hit and changed it to an error. But Rosenberg said, "I called it an error right away. The Yankees in the dugout were giving me the finger."
It was crazy. There was a camera shot of the entire Yankees coaching staff staring at Rosenberg like they were coming. Like,
yeah,
I mean it was uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah, it was. So there was the ball was hit to Mike Blowers. He dropped it. He threw to first. Sosa dove head first. He was safe, and that's how I looked at it. They called it a hit. Then they called it an error, and the no hitter.
I thought it was a definite error. I mean, he played the ball terribly. Yeah. Let it like come up on him, and then obviously Sammy was fast back then. So, but one of the things that. That stood out about that to me was that Hawk was a big proponent of the no-hitter.
Yes.
Hawk was like, you can't – I want Sammy to get the hit, but you can't call a hit on that.
Not only that, there was – it was earlier in the game when the first walk that broke up the perfect game, mm-hmm. it, you know, it's a White Sox player is walking. It's like, all right, you're finally getting to this pitcher. You expect Hawk to be like, all right, go get him, boys. Instead, he's like, I would have called it strike three. He's like, yeah. I would have rung him up because I wanted that perfect game to keep going.
It was Karkovice who drew that walk, who was, by the way – 26 years old?
He looked like he was 36. He looked like an old man.
He was born looking 36.
Sosa steals second base. Then Hawkins walks Ozzie Guillen. He then walks Lance Johnson. The bases are loaded. This no-hitter is continuing. It's still no score. Robin Ventura is at the plate. He hits a routine fly ball to left. Jim Leyritz was a rookie. He had been in the majors. For 3 weeks, he hit two home runs the night before. But on this day, here is what happened.
Sammy at third, Ozzie at second, Lance at first. Outfield bunch swung around to the left. That's hit in the left field playable. Leyritz fighting the wind, drops the ball! Everybody's going to score, and the Sox lead it 3-0. Yes!
Well, you said it earlier, Hawk. Larritz had been a catcher, and he played third base the first two games of this series. And I'll tell you what, that ball carried very, very well right there. The ball had been coming in all afternoon in defense of Larritz. Now watch this. It doesn't appear to be going very well. Didn't hit it very well. Now he is just, that ball is bouncing around on him right there. You could see him getting his angle turned around. He had no chance. He was bouncing. His head was bouncing the whole time. He was on his heels. And that's what happens to you. He really got spun himself around a couple times. Great break for the White Sox. Oh, my.
So the Sox score three runs on no hits. The ball hit Larritz on the hand. It ricochets, and they score three runs.
I watched the play four times. It's a terrible. I don't blame the wind at all. I just blame a guy who probably shouldn't have been in left field. It should have been caught. I just don't see it. I watched it four different times thinking the sun becomes an issue for the next player you're probably going to talk about. Yeah. But it's not nearly as much of an issue for Larritz out and left.
The defense in this game in general was just atrocious. Robin gets redeemed by the baseball gods. He made two awful plays at third base prior to that and then gets the benefit of the awful play in left field. But, I mean, we talked about the error that allowed Sosa to reach base. You're going to talk about another terrible play in right field. I mean, just the defense all around in this game. Had these guys never played in the wind and the sun before? My goodness.
I think that, you know, you had the sun and wind. I'll cut them a little more slack.
Do you know what the wind was?
I looked at that.
I think it's inaccurate because the wind inside the park was slowly swirling.
When it was blowing
around.
Right to left, and it was.
It was 16 miles per
16
hour.
16 miles an hour. Right. It was blowing right to left, which would affect Larritz more. I just think it was a guy who was out of position, who definitely probably shouldn't have been out there in left field, and made an awful play in left field. However, I do think it's one of Hawk's like gem calls that we all forget about. Because he's like, drops the ball. He drops the ball, and everyone's going to score. The White Sox lead it 3-0. Yes.
He just goes, ape, you know what.
Yeah. It was a good inning for Hawk. I mean, you think we glossed over something that was earlier.
Good inning for Hawk.
It was funny. Listen, earlier in the inning, Fletcher hit his foul ball, and there was a great play by a fan, and this fan with a giant mullet. And Hawk wants to say, this is a great catch by one of our lady fans down there, but he can't tell whether or not it's a woman or not. And you can hear him say, I can't tell. I'm looking for the bra strap. He actually said that. And it's kind of like I had to hear it again. I'm like, wait a minute. He really did say
Judging
that.
Judging by the attendance in that game, if the person had a shirt on, it was a woman.
Yes.
Now, I was debating whether to bring that up or not, so I'm glad you did, Kampkin. Yeah. It's not on me.
So Jim Larritz had played only 20. For his whole career, I think he played 22 games in left field.
Should have never played another one after that.
He said after the game, it was hit right at me. It got caught up in the wind, and I couldn't reach it. So now to the next batter. After this crazy play has happened.
Before you get into do you know what happened in between these two plays?
What?
The fans all go nuts because they react to the final score of the Blue Jays-A's game on July 1st.
Hawk is giving inning-by-inning updates of what's happening in the A's-Jays game at Sky Dome up in Toronto. It's July 1st.
Yeah.
That's pretty early to be scoreboard watching, but they were pumped about it.
Yeah, yeah. So the next batter is Ivan Calderon. He hits the ball into right field. Jesse Barfield, a gold glove outfielder, is the right fielder. And this happens.
That's lifted into right field. Jesse is there fighting that win. And the sun. Now he drops it. Robin scores and the Sox lead it 4-0.
Well, the baseball gods are literally shining on the White Sox this afternoon. Mercy. That's what Andy Hawkins needs right now is a little mercy. He delivers the fastball up and away. Calderon hits what appears to be a routine fly to right. Here's Jesse Barfield battling the wind, and the sun loses it. Bingo. E9s. White Sox lead it 4-0.
So another run scores. It's now 4-0 White Sox, and they do not have a single hit off Andy Hawkins. Calderon said after the game, I lost it in the sun coming down. The call was right. It was an error. They cut to Stump Merrill, who is the manager of the Yankees, after this play, and he says, all right, Tony, I'm going to swear, okay? You might have to beep this out. Son of a
I think you just put the explicit thing on the podcast. That'd be great.
In case Tony Gill ends up beeping it out, he said, "Son of a bleeping bleep." That's what he said.
By the way, Merrill, you notice Merrill was managing that game. I believe he's the last Yankees manager to finish his tenure at the Yankees with a losing record.
Wow.
The last one to do
it. That's good.
And I believe the only reason he was managing was, if you'd notice, the Yankees on their sleeves, they all had a number one on their sleeves. Billy Martin had died Christmas Day in 1989. So he would have probably still been the Yankees manager if George hadn't have fired him within the first couple weeks of the season.
Stump said after the game about what had transpired. He said, "Incredible. I've never seen anything like that in my life." We still have not seen it. So the White Sox score 4 runs on 3 errors and 2 walks. And we go to the ninth, and Hawkins still has a no-hitter. Scott Rudinsky pitches the ninth. Mattingly flies out to center. Barfield then hits into a double play to end it. And once again, we got to talk about Hawk. Hawk's call for the final out. Ladies and gentlemen, here we go.
This could be it. Awesome. Fletcher, rack him up. And the ball game is over as the Sox get no hit by Andy Hawkins, and they win it 4-0. Yes!
So there you have it, the Yankees, no runs on 4 hits. The White Sox, 4 runs on no hits. And who gets the victory? Who is the vulture, Chris Kamka?
Well, it's Barry Jones, who had 11 wins in 1990 without a single start. He is the last White Sox pitcher to accomplish that. And it was pretty, I mean.
He looked like a Barry Jones, didn't he? He just
does. And then where
you know what? Barry Jones and Steve Bell. Barry Jones looks like Barry Jones. Steve Balboni looks like a Steve Balboni.
And eventually, Barry Jones turned into Tim Raines, who they flipped into Montreal for after the season.
Nice.
So
good stuff. Hawkins threw 131 pitches total, 37 pitches in that eighth inning.
24 minutes, 3 seconds, that bottom of the eighth.
All right. So let's hear my interview with Andy Hawkins. I called him up. Through a stroke of luck, I was able to get his phone number, and I called him. And he picked right up, which was great. He said he was not mad at Leiritz for dropping the ball. He told Jim afterwards, "Hey, you tried your best." And here is much more that Andy Hawkins says today about this crazy, insane game from yesterday, 1990. You know, you look back on it, and there's been distance. Many years have passed since then, but how did you honestly feel after you pitched your heart out, you get a no-hitter, and lose the game? How difficult was that for you?
You know, growing up, you never even consider something like this happening. You always envision yourself throwing a no-hitter, being carried off the field by your teammates, and everything's hunky-dory. And after that inning was over, I'm sitting on the bench with Billy Connor, the pitching coach, and he congratulated me. I said, "What for?" He said, "You just threw a no-hitter." I didn't even think it counted. I mean, it was so foreign that something like that could happen during a no-hitter. I just never considered it. And I was kind of stunned, you know. I just didn't really know what to think because I'd never even considered something like that happening before.
Do people still bring this up to you, this game? Obviously, I'm bringing it up to you, but I'm just wondering how many people remember it and when they see you, bring it up to you.
I'm reminded of it every year. I mean, it's almost like an anniversary. You know, sometime in July, they either show it on classic games of ESPN or ESPN Classic, or somebody sees it. It's being brought up every year, so it's not an unpleasant memory by any means. It was a thing that happened, and I think it's only happened 3 times in the history of the game, so it's kind of got a little anonymity there. But you know, it's not what you envisioned it to be, but it's the way it was, and that was the way my no-hitter went down.
And I think one thing that's lost in history is not just this game, but what happened in your next 2 starts. Yes, I know what happened in your next 2 starts.
Well, we went back to New York, and my next start was against Minnesota. And I may be clouded here, but I think I went 11 innings that day, or 10 and two-thirds, one of the two.
11 scoreless. It started out with 11 scoreless.
Yeah, I think I got beat 2-0, as I recall. So I had two best starts of my entire big league career, and I was 0-2 at the end of them. Tough league.
It is a tough league. Do you want to talk about what happened in your next start, the third start?
Remind me there what happened.
You faced the White Sox again. What did Melito Perez do?
Oh, that was that rain short no-hitter. Yeah, I remember that now. It was an odd year that year. I had some weird things happen. It just occurred that three of them in a row, three starts in a row, and I'm sitting there at the end of the game, and I'm just shaking my head like, wow, what do you have to do to win in this league?
Yeah,
easier in the National League, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying the baseball gods were against you, but if you do believe in baseball gods, you had to be thinking, what did I do to deserve this?
I tell you what, the baseball god and the one most people pray to are two entirely different entities. Baseball god has got a sick sense of humor, I got to tell you. A lot of weird things happened that day. I got a standing ovation from the Chicago crowd, you know, and went back in the clubhouse after the interview, and I got a standing ovation from my teammates in the clubhouse. So there were some special memories about that day.
They gave you a standing ovation.
Yeah, it was weird.
I
still hear about it.
Say that again?
It was weird. I still hear about it. You know, like I say, I'm reminded of this every year. It's not an unpleasant thing for me. Not at all.
Yeah. That had to feel good. You go back into the clubhouse after what could have been the most deflating experience of your career, and there's your team there giving you a standing ovation.
I cried. I got to tell you, I never had that happen before. But nobody got undressed. Nobody took their hats off. They just stood up in front of their locker, and they gave me a standing ovation when I walked in the clubhouse. It's something I'll never forget.
Now, that really filled in a lot of blanks for me, because after the game, Tom Seaver interviews Hawkins on the field, then the media, the New York media, surrounds Hawkins on the field, and then that's all I know. To then hear him say that during that entire time, not a single Yankees player had taken their uniform off and gave him a standing ovation, and he cried. I mean, that just, the whole thing goes full circle for me from a storytelling standpoint.
Yeah, and what I love about the call you had with him is that 30 years later, he's probably the exact same guy as he was back then. He wasn't angry. I mean, the stroke of bad luck, you can't even make it up. He looks at it as a good day rather than a bad thing, and he should. I mean, he had a hell of a feat for just – and it's every year he's reminded of it, and that's a good thing for him. He should be reminded of it. It was a great game. And the memory of those guys being in the clubhouse with the uniforms on to give him a standing ovation is a complete validation in everything he needed to know about how special that performance was.
And so that – and at the time, that was the sixth no-hitter of 1990. It would end up being – one of nine no-hitters.
How many were thrown that weekend?
Well,
got them right here. Wow. Three no-hitters that weekend.
And two on the same day by Dave Stewart and Fernando Valenzuela on the 29th. Hawkins on the 1st. And then, nine no-hitters, including a combined one. But it wouldn't always remain at nine no-hitters.
Yes. You say something first, Vinny.
Well, Hawk talks about the Valenzuela no-hitter. He said he turned it on to watch it, and the announcers were doing the whole don't jinx the no-hitter thing, and they didn't mention it on the broadcast enough, so he didn't know a no-hitter was going on. So he turned it off and watched a movie, and then he read the paper the next day and found out that he had turned off a no-hitter.
Do you think the movie had Chuck Norris in it?
Do I think? I also like the line, well, I sat down to watch the Valenzuela game the other day. I was eating a sandwich.
He has to disclose what he was eating, and it was a sandwich. So what's happened between then and now is that this is no longer considered. This is the the terrible thing, right? If you're Andy Hawkins, it's no longer considered a no-hitter.
And it's too bad, because it would have created this little fun nugget. That would have gone down as the last no-hitter at Old Comiskey. The first no-hitter at New Comiskey was Burley's in 2007. What's the common theme in there? Sammy Sosa played in both games. But unfortunately, on September 4th, 1991, which happened to be Hawk Harrelson's 50th birthday, Faye Vincent, the chairman, who chaired the MLB Committee for Statistical Accuracy, defined a no-hit game as one in which a pitcher or pitchers complete a game of nine or more innings without allowing a hit. So that one was off the boards, and the Melito Perez range shortened one was off the boards at that point.
So the reason that's no longer a no-hitter is not because he didn't win.
Correct.
It's because he didn't get a chance to pitch the ninth inning because he was pitching as the road pitcher and he was behind.
That's correct. So, and a fun little nugget on that, there is one pitcher that lost an official no-hitter, and that's Ken Johnson of the Houston in 1964. He had nine innings, no hits, one run. It was unearned, obviously, against Cincinnati. Now, in the top of the ninth inning, Pete Rose reaches on an error, and he eventually scored on another error by the second baseman, who was Nellie Fox.
Here's a quote from Ken Johnson, who, after this Hawkins game, it was considered a no-hitter at the time. He said, "I'm sorry to hear that Andy Hawkins joined me in this club. I was very happy being the only man to lose a no-hitter."
There needs to be an addendum to the addendum.
Yeah,
I mean, that's more bad luck. Like, it's not his fault that the Yankees didn't score four runs in the ninth inning. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, and then there would be one more game to join that. Matt Young for the Red Sox, April 12th, 1992, game one of a doubleheader. Same deal, eight innings, no runs, two runs, both those were both earned against the Indians.
One thing we have not discussed are the commercials. This is right in the wheelhouse of Vinny Duber. The 1990 commercials, what did you see?
Well, first things first, I've only got a couple more payments left on my car. And so when that's all done, I might be in the market for a new vehicle. And I think right at the top of the list got to be a 1990 Plymouth Sundance. I mean, that car. Ooh, gorgeous. Yikes. Yeah, these commercials were fantastic. Chuck, were you old enough to drink Bud Dry? What did that taste like?
Never heard about Bud Dry. There was a Bud Dry.
I told Vinny, I prefer my beer wet.
Bud Dry?
It sounds like a bottle full of sand.
Yeah, who wants Bud Dry?
Shockingly not available in 2020.
Yeah, or 1991.
Yeah, I remember the jingle. Why ask why? Try Bud Dry.
that's not a good selling point at all.
Bud Dry sounds like deodorant.
Yeah, that person definitely lost their job within like 18 months.
Okay. We got a great O'Doul's commercial in there too. Jay Hilgenberg, former Bears great, was doing the ads for come on down to Comiskey Park. So that was exciting. Two distant replays now. We've got celebrity Sox fans doing the ads. Jay Hilgenberg joins Laurie Metcalf on that illustrious list. Yeah.
I remember those ads. You know, come on down to the final season of Comiskey Park.
And I thought the Budweiser ads that are just kind of like, I mean, if they would have shown those in other countries. Wow. I mean, it was just like, this is Budweiser and we are America. F you.
one of them featured the Stray Cats as Rock This Town in there. We got to see Spuds McKenzie in an airplane. It was very exciting.
So some of us watched the game feed that didn't have commercials. That would be me. Others, like Guff and Vinny, watched it with commercials.
Yeah, I watched that one too. He missed good Sports Channel commercials.
I missed all that.
Featuring CFL football and the 3-on-3 shoot the bull round ball classic. Yes.
We also need you to grow a mustache and reboot On the Bench.
Oh yeah, On the Bench.
Was that a show on Sports Channel?
Bobby Thigpen.
Bobby Thigpen was going to be on as a guest.
Never heard of it.
But the host is required to have a big thick mustache. So.
That will not be me.
Bring it, Chuck. Come on.
All right. So the White Sox in 1990. This team that we've been talking about won 94 games. Nine games behind the A's, who won 103. They had the second-best record in the American League, and the tragedy of it all, if you are under the age of 30, this is a message to you. Once upon a time, if you won 94 games, chances are you're not going to the frickin' playoffs, and they didn't go to the playoffs. The only teams that made it were the division winners, and so the White Sox with 94 wins were done at the end of the regular season.
You win 94 games, and not only are you not going to the playoffs, you're knocking down your ballpark.
It was a bad year for Sox fans.
Yeah, also,
or ending of the year.
Perhaps more angry, though, or anger-inducing for millennials such as myself watching this is, believe it or not, you also had no idea what the count was at any given moment.
Yeah, you were really worked up about that. Sox had the third-best record in all of baseball.
Yeah.
Only the Pirates and the A's had a better record. Sox were six games better than a division-winning Boston Red Sox.
Such an improbable season. So I'd love to be able to relive that because some of the names on the team.
You know, in some ways, the 2000 White Sox were a little 1990 White Sox.
Yeah.
I mean, off the kids can play. Yeah, they see how they marketed that team, and then all of a sudden they win 95 games.
Well, this was fun, guys. That's a wrap for this edition of Distant Replay. We'll have to come up with another one. We're kind of already starting to talk about some ideas for the future. And by the way, Sox Fest is this week. New location, McCormick Place, January 24th and 25th, just Friday and Saturday. And we've got a big show planned for the 24th. Friday night, 7 p.m., something new. We haven't done this before. Sox Fest at night on NBC Sports Chicago Plus, or if you're there at Sox Fest, it's on at 7. You can see it in person. Jason Benetti and I are hosting this show, and our guests, how about this guest list?
That's not bad. You're welcome.
Keuchel, you're welcome.
No, the Sox really are awesome. They really are.
Keuchel, Grandal, Jimenez, Giolito, Moncada, Anderson, Abreu, Luis Robert, Rick Hahn, and Rick Renteria all scheduled to appear on this one-hour show.
And some surprises.
There's definitely at least one surprise, maybe more.
I'll figure a way to get another one in
okay,
there.
Okay. So we have one. Right now we have one surprise. But we'll see if we can get another surprise. So that's going to be on Friday night, NBC. I almost said Sports Channel Plus because I'm just in the Sports Channel mode. On NBC Sports Chicago Plus channel. So be on the lookout for that. This was fun, guys.
Always.
Yes. Our thanks to Andy Hawkins for coming on the pod and talking about an amazing moment of his career and one that he will never forget.
It was one that game was in the middle of an 0 for 37 stretch by hitters against Andy Hawkins.
I hope his luck's changed.
He was most recently, 2016 and 19, the Omaha Storm Chasers pitching coach.
And is not the coach anymore.
No.
So maybe
no,
the luck
not.
Changed. Yep. Should we edit that out?
tough ending.
He'll get a job somewhere. He said, look, I've had a great run in baseball. We'll see if it's 34 years in baseball, good for him. And that's going to be a wrap for this edition of the White Sox Talk Podcast.
I held it as long as I could.
I'm keeping all this in. Bro.
All right, I got to do this. Maybe you should read the outro. It's brought to you by Wintrust, your home for White Sox. Checking with free ATMs nationwide. Go to the special White Sox webpage. It is www.wintrust.com/Sox. You have something you want to add before we wrap it up.
This copyright podcast is presented by the authority of Major League Baseball and the Chicago White Sox. It is intended solely for the private, non-commercial use and our audience. Any publication, reproduction, retransmission, or other use of the pictures, descriptions, and accounts of this podcast without the express written permission of MLB, the Chicago White Sox, and NBC Sports Chicago is strictly prohibited.
Have you always wanted to say that? Is that why you did that?
Yeah.
I was like, where are you going with this?
If it was the Hawkeroo, you got into with prohibited. Yes.
Oh, we didn't say the one last thing, the sign that was in the crowd. The ones. Okay.
Just throw to it and end it.
All right. At one point, they go to the crowd. There are fans with a sign that says, "We are from Georgia. We watch the White Sox on Sports Channel in Georgia." And Hawk goes, "Georgia? Yes!" Silence. Hawk Harrelson, take it away.
Thanks, Art Chuck. And this edition of the White Sox Talk Podcast is over!